to California.
It was another year and a half.
I see. So you mentioned your father's health broke around age 53.
Yes.
Which would have been 1914.
It would have been 14, I guess. Yes.
But you stayed on then in Calumet before moving.
They went. He was taken very... He had a brief spell of illness. I forget the exact year, but he had this brief spell in which he left the Tamarack Hospital, and he'd gone half a mile in his car. When he got this terrible pain, he went back, and he was in bed there 2 or 3 days, and he was sure it was appendicitis. And he yelled, "Give me a knife, I'll cut it off myself." So I was told. But after about 3 or 4 days, he recovered. And he was seemed all right for another couple of years, and then he had a terrible attack again. And now they used to have 7 or 8 doctors all come to see him, and one said, "It's this, you should cut this out." The other said, "It's this," and they all had different ideas. But fortunately, there were a lot of them, and no two would agree, so they didn't do anything to him, but he was in awful pain. And then he went away, and he went to Mayo Brothers. And they put a thing down his throat, and they said it was cancer. And I was told at noon that he had cancer and couldn't live over 2 years. Actually, he lived nearly 20. So it wasn't cancer at all. But that's what they said it was. And I felt so as a result of it that when the boys were fooling around, I thought of this, and I began to weep. And the boys all rebuked me for... that I should be manly enough not to get upset about the little thing they had done. I didn't tell them why it really was.
But this was playing with playmates?
Yes.
I see. Yes. They didn't know it was because of your father's condition.
No, they had no idea.
Do you know to this day what his condition was?
Yes, it was a nervous ailment. And it affected his... He went to Battle Creek Sanatorium, and they fixed him up, baths and whatnot, and relaxed him and got to where he came back home and was going to start his practice. And then, I hadn't heard of it before, having this trouble with the esophagus. It would just close right up. He couldn't get even water down.
Hmm.
And he went on for... he'd have to take a string and try to swallow it. And then it'd take 2 or 3 hours to get the end of the string swallowed. And then there was a little hole at the end of a thing they called a bougie, which was like a rounded off thing at the end and then a long, somewhat flexible, thick. And they would put that down his throat. And I guess it was quite painful, but it would open it up and then he could eat. And if he'd have it done a week later, then he could. But if it worked well, he would go for 10 days, and then it would get so tight they'd have to do it twice before he was. Fortunately, when we got to California, there was a retired doctor a couple of blocks from us. And this fellow said, "You don't need the strain, I can do it without." And that was a help, because it was a strain looking forward to it. Now he would get to a point where he had to have that. And he would phone this man, and within 5 minutes he was there and had the thing down his throat.
Hmm.
It was very painful. He had that for years. And then finally, after, 15 years of that, finally, there was an old classmate of his came, a medical classmate, came to work in a hospital in Pasadena, and he told him, he said, "I think we can stretch that so you won't have to have that." So he went to the hospital, and they put him under ether, and they stretched it, and after that he didn't need the bougie anymore. After 15 years of that misery. And then I was back in the summer visiting, and my father said, "I've got to go and see the doctor again." He was blind by this time. And I went over with him, and we saw Dr. Doc was his name. And Dr. Doc said, "No," he says, "I don't know whether we ought to stretch the throat again," he said. "You come in, we'll give you the ether and stretch the throat again. If you do that," he says, "it would last you permanently." Whereas You may get it again where you have to have it. But he said, I could see my father begin to shake as he thought of it. You know, he's nervous. And then Dr. Doc said, "But," he says, "I don't know as you need to do it." He said, "After all, this may last you the rest of your life." And he said, "If it goes wrong, you could come in any time and have it done." That is, he said, provided the surgeon, it was a young surgeon that had done it, provided he's here. But he says, "You'll have to plan your trip when he's available," because he said, "I suppose 15 years from now, he'll have to have his appendix taken off. And I suppose 20 years from now, he'll have to have a gallbladder operation." And as he said these things, the young surgeon went this way, shaking, and he turned to me and he says, "I suppose it's all true, but I hate to think of it." And Dr. Doc seemed to get so much pleasure out of making my father feel miserable and making the surgeon feel miserable, that when I heard 6 months later that he was having his appendix out, I didn't feel a bit sorry for him. That was a lot of misery he had to go through with that. It was evidently a nervous symptom that would cause that to tighten up. You couldn't even get water down. But with the bougie, they would open it, and it would last a week all right. And if you went 10 days, then it might only last 2 days. When I went to Montana, Father drove me to the train, and the fog was so bad I had to stand out on the running board of the car to see. You couldn't see, hardly see through the window, to tell him where to go. And all the way to Montana, I wondered whether he got home safely. But I don't know how he did it. I hardly ever saw such fog. Though I remember as a boy sometimes hearing the foghorns out on Lake Superior. Of course, they had no radar in those days, so they had to blow these big horns. One time when I was going to Europe, I got on the boat, the ship in Hoboken, and the ship went half an hour, and it stopped. And the ship stopped and stayed there for 5 hours, stationary. And the reason was the fog had settled in the harbor there. You couldn't see. You couldn't see 30 feet from the boat, and it just stopped there. And then, after 5 hours, the fog lifted, and you could see other ships all around you. You know. There was the Statue of Liberty right over there, you know. But you couldn't see a thing until it lifted. So that was a trip to Europe that didn't go far before it stopped.
It had gone only a little, how long did you
maybe stay? Half an hour, 20 minutes
and
or half an hour.
And then stopped right there in the harbor. Yeah.
Huh. Stay right there, and there must have been 50 other ships that were in the same situation. Just had to just stop and wait for the fog.
When you sailed in and out of New York different times, did you always saw the Statue of Liberty?
Yes, unless you came in at night, of course.
Was that kind of a special?
Oh, yes. But you know, the greatest thrill I ever had of thing, strange, after my first year studying in Germany, I decided to come back home for the summer. And I went to the bank, and I gave them $100 in the German currency and asked them to give me American currency. And they handed me 10 $10 bills. And as I took those, the cold chills went up and down my back. And I got more thrill out of seeing that American money than I think almost than I did of actually getting here.
Huh.
It was so unexpected, you know.
So much. Huh. And there had been nothing American for so long in your life.
Yeah.
In terms of daily experience.
Yeah. Yes, it was so different.
Huh.
But it's strange how you get a thing like that at an unexpected place. And when I went over in 1947 to get books for a seminary library, I visited Scotland, and I expected to enjoy it and find it very interesting, and I did. It was what I expected. But somebody said, "You better go to Ireland. There you can buy a lot of good books cheap." And I went over to Ireland with no expectation. And the result was that everything thrilled me. And I got more pleasure out of the visit to Ireland
that I did describe. Because it was unexpected and not just what you... I mean, the pleasure I got out of it, I just went there to get the books. While in Scotland, I went to get the books and to see the country that I had heard a lot about.
Sure.
So the Irish trip really thrilled me more.
So then the family moved to California in about 1915 or 16?
Father and mother went out there the first winter, and they came back and they said how you could plan a picnic 6 weeks ahead and know it wouldn't rain. Oh, I thought that was tremendous. But so often our weather was so uncertain, you know. And then in the fall of 1916, they went out. And then in December, my aunt and my sister and I left Calumet and took the train to Chicago. And then took the train from Chicago there. And
this is an interview with Dr. Alan Alexander McRae for the Archives of Biblical Theological Seminary by Jim Pakula in Dr. McRae's living room on the campus of the seminary in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, on Friday. Well, Dr. McRae, you were telling last time about your trip to Montana, your time in Montana during the summer of 1915 in the Bitterroot Valley after ninth grade, and it said some things about your father's health. So why don't we pick up from there, as you suggested, and continue.
Fine. When I got back from Montana that summer, I did not know of some developments that had occurred in the community. I believe I've mentioned that though our community was one which had a great many nationalities in it, it was a very peaceful community. I think I heard of somebody who visited Calumet once who said that that was an area that was renowned for the great number of rocks and the great number of children. But I know there were many children when I was there, and I've often felt sorry for children since in areas where they don't have many playmates, because we had many, many playmates, playmates of many different nationalities, and they all played together, and it was very nice. Well, that fall... I might mention here that I have heard more recently how during the previous year, the president of the Western Federation of Miners from Butte, Montana, had made a visit to Calumet and had begun to try to organize the men in the who worked in the mines. Well, that fall... I knew nothing about this, but soon after I came back, we saw a big parade in which a great many miners and other workers in connection with the mining companies marched with great big placards that had such statements on them as "The One-Man Machine, Our Enemy." And I began to hear the stories were being circulated that formerly two men worked on a machine. Now they had different machines, and that men were just getting absolutely exhausted from using these. Well, to my mind, as we look at the number of hours most people work nowadays, it's no wonder if people got exhausted, because in those days they worked 6 hours, 6 days a week, always. And I believe more have to be 10 hours a day than eight. The hours were much longer, I believe, than they are now, most anywhere.
Now, how could people do that?
Well, they were stronger breed in those days than today.
But I mean, when did they get all of the types of things that we normally try to squeeze into a Saturday done?
I don't know, sure. Of course, in those days, none of the women worked. Practically none ever did. And in our area, there were a great many of the Cousin Jacks, as I've mentioned before. And among them, it was considered very rude not to have much more on the table than you could possibly eat. I heard people say that from their garbage pails you could have fed people in most areas. There was a tremendous lot wasted. And in fact, before World War I, it was quite generally said that when you ate anywhere of almost any dish, you were supposed to leave a little for minus in your plate. It was in World War I that they had the propaganda that we must not waste, and I think it made a change in our general attitudes. But as I was mentioning, I saw this parade, and they had these big banners and signs, and then along in the fall, the strike started. And our house was on the corner in Centennial. The streetcar stopped, I guess the trolley car they call it in the east here. Really wasn't a streetcar because it ran between the little towns in our area. The Houghton County Traction Company had a number of lines, different, which went to the different sections around there. And in the morning, the train would come down, the car would come and would stop on the corner right across the street from our house. And there was picket fence around our yard. And in front of that picket fence, there would be 8 or 10 strikers would stand. And then when the car, when the trolley car started, there might be 6 or 8 men get off with their dinner pails in their hands to go to work at the Centennial Mine, which was a long block back of us. It went back through a sort of a bush, we called it. The road went through this bush with little trees and a little ditch running through it, and back there to the mine and the various, the carpenter shop and the machine shop and these things connected with the mine. And when these men would get across off the car and start for the back, the men who were standing in front there would attack them. And we would see some knocked over and blood flowing from hitting them on the head and so on. And it was a kind of a miserable introduction to the world of industrial strife for a boy of 13 to see that. Well, before long, there were some things such as we had never had before in the copper country. There were a few instances where the house of a man who had continued working was blown up with dynamite, a few things like that. Things began to get to such a state that they made a great many of the workers, of those who were still working, were commissioned as deputy sheriffs. And there were some fights between them. The miners' bulletin was issued, which was strong propaganda for the strikers. And the newspaper, the Houghton County Mining Gazette, generally took the other viewpoint. And then eventually a little paper called Truth was circulated, which was supposed to show the company's viewpoint. And my father was active in medical work, going to the homes of all the different people and hearing them talk about each other. And I remember his telling Helen, one of the strikers' homes, how they had placed the cuspidor on top of the copy of the magazine, of the paper Truth. And he said, "Truth crushed to earth will rise again." Of course, it was clearly a joke and they just laughed about it. But I think as the fall went on, see, as I look back, it's hard to realize things moved quite that fast. But they organized what they called the Citizens Alliance with the people who wanted law and order. And they had a big march of people, the Citizens Alliance. And about this time, there was a man from Chicago connected with a magazine called The Survey, I believe it's the name of it. I haven't heard it mentioned in all these years, but it was quite widely read at that time. And his father had been minister in an area where my mother had died years before. So when he came up, we entertained him and had a number of visits with him, and he interviewed different people and took pictures. And then when the article came out in The Survey, it told about the terrible conditions under which the men lived up there. And there was a picture of, it said, a miner's dwelling, something like that. And there was a picture of a little shack that some boys had built in the bush just for their boys' playtimes, and it was pictured in there as a miner's home, and it gave a picture, an altogether distorted picture of the situation. Now, it is true, the Calumet and Hecla mine owned just about everything in the area. They owned all the land. That is, people would buy land, but below 10 feet or so, 15 maybe, they owned all the mineral rights, everything below. In fact, when we'd go in our cellar often, we could hear the shaking from the blasting deep in the mines. But the company provided hospitals, medical service very cheaply, as I've mentioned before, a dollar a person, single man, dollar and a half when we're married, for all the medical attention you might want, medicines and everything. And it was a sort of a paternalistic general setup, pretty much. There was, in later years, that naturally changed very greatly. But this brought a big disruption of the whole situation. And then there was a hall called the Italian Hall. And on Christmas Eve, they had a party there for the children and for people. It was crowded with strikers, people who did not have much means of those circumstances, and they were giving out presents to them. And according to what one of the boys, the son of one of the strikers, told me later, there was a man with a Citizens Alliance button on him who suddenly yelled fire in the place. And there's no proof as to how it started. But at any rate, there was a wild rush for the back door and down the stairs, and such a rush that people were trampled. I think 80 people were trampled to death. It was a terrible disaster. And, of course, received national publicity from it on that occasion. And according to a story I heard, that when members of the Citizen Alliance came by the place or when the funeral was held, that some people said, "Now you've killed him, eat him." But this gives an illustration of the feeling that was there, so different from anything that we had felt was there before. And of course, after this, there was a great demand for copper for a couple of years on account of the war, but that was over before long, and the mine sank back into the prosperity of the place. Never was recovered. And of course, a great many of the people moved away from it. But that was an interesting section of my education, was the events of that year, which was my second year in high school. The following summer, I went to camps, YMCA and Boy Scouts. A man who had been a secretary in the YMCA in town, and by the way, that was quite a fine YMCA in those days. I think it's, the last time I was up there, I found just an empty space where the building had been. But it impressed me as a very fine building with fine athletic equipment. And the youngsters could come in, the boys, and play games and so on. After it, they were supposed to stay for a Bible lesson, which consisted in simply a description of the various places Paul visited on his missionary journey, and didn't convey much spiritual meaning. But this man, who was one of their secretaries, had a disagreement with the other people and left and organized a group of the Boy Scouts. And so I went to the YMCA camp and then to the Boy Scout camp, and the competition between them, we youngsters were the beneficiaries of. I remember you could, for a very cheap price, you could buy a good hunk of first-class beef, and we would heat a stone and cook it on the stone. I mean, in these days, the price of such a thing is hardly conceivable, I would think. But it was during that fall that my father had the bad illness, and he and my mother made a visit to California, and they wrote back of how you could you could plan a picnic weeks ahead and know that the weather would be good. That's what impressed them, so, because our weather was so uncertain all the time. But they decided then, the next summer, that they would he would retire and that we would move to California. So it was the next fall which I began my work in the high school. I don't know as I mentioned, I think it was the second year that my father came back from a Radical Association convention and he brought a typewriter. And he had no intention of using it. He brought it for me. So I went into the high school in that fall and I signed up for the regular course. They had six courses, three vocational and three college preparatory. And the stiffest of the college preparatory was called the Latin course. And I signed up for the next year, second year, I think that was, of the Latin course. And after the courses, I wrote down typewriter, signed up for that. And they called me in the principal's office, and he said, this doesn't fit with your course, take typewriter. There were other boys who were taking typing, shorthand, all these things, but they were in the commercial course, or the vocational course. Well, I said, I want to learn to type. He says, yes, but it doesn't fit with your course. Well, I said, I want to learn to type. I said, we'll let you. But he says, we won't give you any credit for it. Well, I took the course and I jumped in and I learned to type with a touch system, and I've always been grateful for that. And I used to carry a hand typewriter with me, and waiting for a train or a bus, something I'd put on my lap and type a letter, and I wouldn't give anything for having learned that. But, I've often thought, if only that principal had encouraged me and said, well, now, why don't you take a course of shorthand, too? That shorthand would have been invaluable to me, just a little shorthand all through the years of education since. But that stupid attitude was resulted in my not getting anything except the one semester of the typing. So I've always been thankful for that. Well, now it was the next year that my father and mother went out to California and left my aunt and my sister and myself there in the fall. And we were to follow them to California. And so I used to enjoy going up in the attic where there were long rows of magazines, the World's Work, I remember particularly, which was so interesting, and other magazines that had been gathered through the years and wondered, think of which we ought to keep. And of course, we threw away all the magazines, I think, but we had a lot of books to take with us, and in December, I went to the principal and asked for a transcript to take with me to California, and he told me how terribly embarrassed he was about my transcript because it all had so many high marks on it, and he said, they'll think we're not much of a school if somebody marks like that. But anyway, he gave me a true record of the marks I had, and the three of us took the train to Chicago and then took the long trip by train from there out to California. And we got off in Pasadena. And the very day that we arrived, that just before we arrived, the boxcar arrived, which, among other things, contained my father's automobile. So he met us at the train in his car. I don't know when that had been shipped, but they took a long time with that sort of thing in those days. Probably do still. That reminds me, incidentally, we spoke about the railroads a little bit, and one time, some years after this, they had the man, I think, did he buy, was it the New York Central Railroad? Yes, he got control of Allegheny Corporation, which had control of it. And he put ads in the paper, a hog can travel from east to west in the same car, but you can't. And, of course, in those days, everybody had to change in Chicago, and you usually had to change stations. Usually we would arrive in the so-called Union Station, where the Pennsylvania State Railroad arrived, and then we would cross to the station from which the Santa Fe Railroad started. I guess it was a block, a long block away. This one was. I forget the stations now. I used to know them all because I would change different directions when I got there. But they put on these cars then in response to this ad. And the cars, you would get a ticket from Los Angeles to New York. In you get a sleeper in the car. And the car would come in to Chicago in the morning. And of course, the way we used to do is we'd walk across town, have some lunch, or we would walk the block or two to the station, or the Parmalee you transfer with. Your car then would be shunted out 10 miles out into to the yards, and it would stay there for several hours, and then it would come back in. And after one experience with that, I got separate ones and took an earlier train than I could get if it went through. But it was so silly, so much that the railroads did. And you think of what they meant to the country and what they could still mean if only they had shown more good judgment in the handling of it. But anyway, we had a pleasant trip out there, and I thought we would be living in Pasadena, so I immediately learned the names of the main streets of Pasadena in order. And it seemed so good to walk in the street without having your feet sink a foot in the snow at every step you took. And I went to Pasadena High School, which I enjoyed very much. I remember the German class was addressed by somebody who had come over on the submarine, the Deutschland, that came from Germany and thus avoided the Allied blockade. I remember a German play there that they put on, Der Neffe als Onkel, Der Nephew as Uncle, which I enjoyed. And I just got nicely settled in the high school. And then they decided that my wife's cousin, second cousin of hers, who lived in Highland Park in Los Angeles, but actually halfway between the center of Pasadena and the center of Los Angeles, that we would move over to be near them.
This was your mother's cousin?
My mother's cousin.
And this was the winter of...
This was the winter
16 and to 17.
We left, I believe we left Calumet in 1916 and arrived there in 1917.
You were in 11th grade then?
I was in the middle of 11th grade.
Yes, okay.
And what a difference in the high school. I was in Pasadena High School only about a month, and I enjoyed it, but don't remember a great deal about it. I do remember hearing, I think, Dr. Millikan give an address at what was then called Troop Institute, but later became called the California Institute of Technology, on the new discovery that all of the chemical elements could be arranged according to the number of, what is it exactly?
The molecular structure.
According to the molecular structure, right in order, right up. It was very interesting.
Sure.
And had an interesting experience about Millikan when I was in college. We might mention later if we have a thing.
Okay.
But over in Highland Park, which was about the nearest part of the city of Los Angeles, my cousin lived there, and he owned some houses. The house he lived in and others he rented, and one of those he rented became vacant, but there was not room enough for us in it. And he moved to it and let us take his house at 1635 Aldana Street, I believe. But we moved there and lived there for nearly a year. But when we first moved, there was a bridge over the arroyo, which was not in shape, and they were replacing it. So we would take the trolley car from Pasadena to the one edge, and then I had to walk across a little footbridge and then get on the other car there to take me in, and started in Franklin High School.
Now, as I said, I can't compare Pasadena High School. I don't recall it a great deal. It's quite a large high school. But there, Franklin High School had just been started the year before. And I was told that there were about six or seven other high schools in Los Angeles, and that they had wanted to start this high school with the teachers who could eventually become heads of departments. I was just thinking the other day, I wonder what Franklin High School is like now, because I was told by a man I met in the mountains about 5 years ago that the whole section of Highland Park where we live was now entirely Spanish. He said, you wouldn't like it there anymore. Well, when I was there, they were practically all old American stock in that area. And it wouldn't make quite a difference. Of course, I don't know what class of Spanish people in that area. I haven't been there since, for many years, in that particular area. But it was a very, very nice section then. And these were the big red cars, as they called them, that went from Pasadena to Los Angeles. Fellow I knew in high school and college used to give lectures on the big red cars, which went all over Southern California in those days to the main towns from one to the other. And then there was also the yellow cars, which were a different company. And they were more local, and there must have been 15 different lines that went out from the center of Los Angeles. I think those have all disappeared now. But
those were interurban railway or light rail.
Those were the red cars. The yellow cars were within the metropolitan area of Los Angeles, which was the largest metropolitan area in the country at the time, because there was a group of very fine people who had taken the leadership in Los Angeles and had looked ahead. Like one thing, the way they looked ahead, they had made an arrangement to bring water from 250 miles to the north through an aqueduct to Los Angeles. And another thing was, they said that in so many cases, the interior of a city degenerates, and the people who work there live out in suburbs around and have no voice in the conduct of the place where they work. So they wanted Los Angeles to be different. And so they extended it one direction and another, and it covered a very, very large area, which I think had great advantages to it.
Sure.
And then Los Angeles needed a harbor. And so early in the present century, they extended a little narrow area going clear down to the shore, and then took in the town of San Pedro down there, so that the town runs 20 miles down to the harbor, and they built San Pedro into a nice harbor.
Sure.
But yes, I think there was a very progressive group that was running the city at that time. But I was saying about Franklin High School, these people, they established it so that these were supposed to later become heads of departments, I understand. But it was quite a small attendance, but a fairly good large building there, because the students who were already going to high schools in other parts of town mostly didn't want to change. So the attendance was rather small during the year and a half that I attended Franklin High School. But the thing, two things impressed me. One was the progressiveness as compared with Calumet, because they had a cafeteria. I'd never heard of that in school before. I'd never heard of food being served in the school before. They had a newspaper, a weekly. They had all these things, you might say folderol, I don't know. But on the other hand, the laxity of it. The teachers, so many of them, just didn't seem to bother. And there was one class, one teacher of history who would walk out all through the room. He'd disappear from the room and leave the students there for half an hour in the course of the hour of teaching. there was an interesting incident that my last year there. But all the requirements. I, in Calumet, we worked, and we really learned there. And I think I had the habit of working, and so my first month there greatly impressed the teachers with my ability, and after that I sent it back into the easygoing manner of the rest of them. So my year and a half there, I didn't get near the training that I would have had if I'd been in Calumet.
Was Pasadena High School better?
The month was not sufficient to know. The classes were large there. They had a great many advantages that a small high school like this wouldn't have. But as to how the workload and the discipline, that sort of thing compared, I just have no record. I can't say. Of course, everything was so new to me in Pasadena High School that I was just enjoying the situation, the atmosphere and everything. And nothing impressed me as markedly different from what I was used to there. Whether they even had a cafeteria or a paper, I just don't recall. But in Franklin, where I then spent a semester, I think I changed just because when the new semester was starting, and it was nearly a month after that before the house could be vacant and the whole family could move over. And each day I had to commute back and forth. But that year and a half wasn't near the value from an education. Oh, another thing, they had a student organization, which we hadn't had, and in Calumet. They had their student organization, they had their election for, a boy would always be student body president, a girl was vice president. And I remember as I came in there, one girl who was vice president of the student body, never occurred to me to speak to her. I didn't feel if I was in her class, hardly, I guess. The next year, I got acquainted with a group of students, which included her, and she told me once how she had thought when I first came that I was very conceited because I didn't speak to her. Shows how easy it is to misinterpret
people. Yeah.
But I then attended the this high school through the spring, made some good friends. Thing that I enjoyed most, though, was seeing the mountains. Oh, there was no smog in those days. And from Highland Park, you could look right up at those glorious mountains north of Pasadena. From Pasadena, they just seemed to tower right above you. And everything in them was so clear. And I sat up at Echo Mountain, to which a train that goes up is pulled up.
An incline,
yes. Yeah, a train used to go up to Echo Mountain, and then they had a trolley car that circled around the hills and took you eventually to Alpine Tavern, which was 5,000 feet up. And Echo Mountain, I don't know, it was 3,500, something like that. But it was pretty steep, quite climb. But there at Echo Mountain, you could sit and look out and see the whole area. You could pick out in Highland Park, which was 10 miles or more away, you could pick out all the little details. Our first picnic, there was a fellow named Lawrence Wright. Eventually, I believe he became a teacher of English. Northwestern, I believe, I'm not sure. Lawrence Wright and a friend of his who was the secretary to a congressman, his wife was the daughter of this congressman, they two and I packed our stuff on our back with our food, mostly canned goods. But we went.
He was a teacher at Franklin High School?
Lawrence Wright was a classmate of mine.
I see. And this was your first camping trip?
My first camping trip in the mountains. Of course, I had camped in Calumet some.
Sure.
But this was my first trip in the mountains.
And that was the spring of 17?
That was the spring of 17. We went up to what they called Barley Flats, which was about 20 miles back. I just loved it there in Barley Flats up on the mountainside. And then we went from there down a valley and then up the other side to a little higher place they called Pine Flats, which
which I liked very much. Barney Flats now has a road to it, but in those days it was a trail you followed. And we camped at Barley Flats, and then the next day we just went about 4 miles along a fairly low ridge separating two valleys for about 4 miles, and then down into the valley a mile, and then 3 miles up to Pine Flats, somewhat higher than Barley. That was very low. Then the next day we had to go from Barley Flats back out to Sierra Madre. And to do that, you had to go down what they called Shortcut Canyon, I believe, and then up over this ridge, and then down to where the river, what was the name of that again, that stream flowed, which had been a little tiny stream up above, but now it had become a fairly good-sized little stream. It was what they called Sturtevant's Camp there, and which had accommodations, tents, and so on. And that day there were a lot of school teachers there. And we came through the camp, sat down and rested just a very few minutes at the camp, and then started up the hill on the other side where you had to go up quite a high climb, and then down the other side, way down to get to Sierra Madre, which was maybe 10, 15 miles east of Pasadena. And we left the place at Sturtevant's camp, and when we got a short distance up, we looked back, and some of these school teachers, who looked rather old to me then, they probably were around 12.